This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. By now, you've certainly become familiar with emojis. You know, those tiny graphic images, the smiley face, the frown, the thumbs up that you insert into your text message. But has this ever happened to you? You send a nice, smiley, happy emoji from your cell phone, but when it shows up on your recipient's phone, it looks more like someone's gritting his teeth. It is not the meaning that you intended. Well, a new study documents that effect, that emoji can be interpreted in a variety of ways. Researchers at the University of Minnesota found that due to differences in graphic design, certain characters could convey a slightly negative emotion when rendered on one mobile phone platform, but a slightly positive emotion when viewed on another platform. And it's not just a problem of translating between Apple-ese and Android-ese. Even within one phone system, different users could interpret a single character in a range of ways. Wow. Joining me now to discuss the challenges of changing communications in the online world and what might be done to prevent emotional contact being lost in emotional translation are Hannah Miller, a PhD student in the Computer Science and Engineering Department at the University of Minnesota and one of the authors of the study. Welcome, Hannah.
Thank you.
And Gretchen McCulloch, a linguist and writer specializing in language online. She gave a talk on the linguistics of emoji at the recent South by Southwest Festival. Welcome, Gretchen.
Hi.
And if you'd like to get emotional with us, you can call us. Our number is 844-724-8255. Hannah, how much could people be confused by these emoji?
What we saw is that people can be confused both in terms of sentiment, so emotion, and semantics and how they would describe it. And overall, we saw over 40% having people differ by more than two ratings on a sentiment scale from negative five or really negative to positive five.
Wow. And where do the characters come from? Is there no standard design that so we all see the same thing?
I'm really glad you asked that, because technically there is a standard through the Unicode Consortium, but all they provide is the code that will allow it to transfer between the different platforms and the name. So, for example, the grinning face with smiling eyes would be all that the different companies have to try to comply with to make their own rendering, and that's why we see such different interpretations for the different renderings.
So phone designers are free to meet whatever they wanted to interpret it as.
Exactly.
Wow. Gretchen McCulloch, were you surprised by this?
I'm not surprised at all. I think this is a great study because it really confirms what a lot of people have been saying anecdotally, that they're not sure what all emoji mean, or their friend's emoji look different on their Android than on their iOS device. And I think that, putting some concrete numbers to a study like this is hopefully something that will lead to better understanding and maybe even better standardization of what these emoji look like across different platforms.
So what's your take on why there is all this confusion? Gretchen.
I think one of the biggest reasons is that certain emoji especially are influenced by Japanese manga standards for what facial expressions look like. So the smiling eyes, the kind of pointy-looking flat eyes that look like a carrot symbol on certain emoji are influenced by Japanese manga conventions that say this is what a smiling eyes character looks like. And if you're not very familiar with manga, and many people in the Western world aren't, you don't really look at those eyes, and you look instead at the mouth, and the mouth looks flat, and we know that the flat mouth is not supposed to be smiling. So I think that kind of cross-cultural differences in what a conventional emotional representation looks like in a smiley face are something that sometimes leads to this misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm. Heather, are there any technological solutions to this? Standardize somehow.
Yes, I think our lab is really interested in looking at what we might be able to do on the technical side. And you could envision building tools such as, for example, maybe being able to see what the rendering was intended to look like. So when you're viewing it, having the ability to see what the sender had sent on the other side, or possibly even more sophisticated tools like being able to automatically detect the likelihood that a certain rendering may be construed differently on another platform.
Hmm. Who decides what emojis, become standard? Who decides what becomes an emoji?
I believe that's on the Unicode consortium side, because they adopt the different Unicode into their standard, and they have an informing board that decides that. But we actually don't have much insight into that, and it'd be really interesting to hear the Unicode's perspective.
Gretchen, sometimes when we create things, they have unintended consequences. You know, have the emojis morphed into that Twilight Zone where they started out being one thing, but suddenly they're being interpreted in a different way?
I mean, I think nobody really anticipated that emoji would become as popular as they were. Initially, emoji were designed to solve this problem that people were sending picture messages to each other, and that takes up a lot of space, particularly in earlier devices. And so they thought they'd standardize some of the most common picture messages that people were sending, and then also add in a bunch of ad hoc symbols that were found in fonts like Webdings and Wingdings, and things that were on like conversions of emoticons from platforms like AOL and MSN, Instant Messenger. And all of these things kind of came together in this conglomeration. No one sat down and said, I'm going to design a typology of all the pictures I think people are going to want. Those pictures got added in a very ad hoc sort of manner, and now they're taking on this additional life in some cases as to what people are using them for.
Mm-hmm. Number 844-724-8255 if you use emojis or want to talk about them, or you could tweet us at SciFry. I learned today that the plural of emoji is emoji. Not emoji. Is it emoji or just emoji?
I think that's an interesting question, because when English borrows in a word from another language, and emoji comes from Japanese, we've historically done two different things. Sometimes we add an S, so we say like tsunami, tsunamis, and sometimes we don't add an S, so we say sushi and still sushi. So with emoji, I think what we're going to do is still up in the air, and some people prefer one or the other. I know the Unicode Consortium does say the plural is emoji, but you definitely hear people saying emojis as well.
And there are some people who say that emoji are a new language, but they're not, are they?
I like to think of emoji as like facial expressions, tone of voice, gestures, all those things that you add on as a kind of paralinguistic extra information on top of the literal words you're saying. And just like you wouldn't want to have a conversation with your hands tied behind your back and a paper bag over your head and in a monotone, it's more enriching to have a conversation that involves emoji rather than just plain words that you're sending to someone.
Mm-hmm. Hannah, this week Android said that it would be redesigning some of its emoji in an upcoming operating system update, making things a little less blobby. A good idea?
I do think it's a good idea, and I think it's important since we have shown that there is this opportunity for varying interpretation, that they work together to try and converge on what people will be able to agree on.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to the phones. Our number 844-724-8255. Skip in North Little Rock, Arkansas. Hi, Skip.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Long time listener.
Oh, thank you.
I make a great deal of use of emojis on Facebook and other media, and I know that they have added a bunch of new ones over time. I am so frustrated that with all of the interesting designs, they've never come up with a decent hug.
A hug? You want to give somebody a hug and you can't.
Absolutely.
What a great idea. Why? Well, Hannah, Gretchen, can we start a movement to get a hug emoji going?
Well, there have been several campaigns to add new emoji. There was a Kickstarter to add a dumpling emoji, which was ultimately successful. And I think Taco Bell spearheaded an effort to add the taco emoji. So certainly people have successfully campaigned to add an emoji, if that's something that you want to get into. And I think a hug would be a great idea.
What do you think, Hannah? You agree?
She actually took the examples right out of my head. I had heard about the taco and the dumpling. So definitely, if you want one added, go ahead and make it happen.
Mm-hmm. How much of this is a problem in the greater scheme of things, of how we talk and text? How much is of having not the right emoji should we be worrying about?
So I think that's something that our lab is We're glad you asked that, because people are really reacting, and because we've shown that this opportunity for miscommunication can occur, but we don't necessarily think that it is so severe that World War III is going to happen because of emoji. And like Gretchen was saying earlier, we also, they supplement our other language, right? And we use them with the surrounding context. And that's something that we want to look in the future is for this study, we looked at them standalone, and looking at them in context, does that change the way that people interpret them, and can it disambiguate and possibly mitigate this problem?
Is there something I can do to make sure that the emoji that I send won't get misinterpreted?
I think the thing is that this study has created awareness of the fact that it might turn out differently on different platforms. And so just thinking about that and thinking maybe who are you sending this to and what device might they see this on, you could even look up what they will see it as. And so just now you can have that awareness that people might be seeing different things and interpreting in different ways.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the other things that I liked about the study was that it showed which emoji are more and less misinterpretable, right? So that you guys found that the hard eyes emoji wasn't very misinterpreted, but the grinning face with smiling eyes emoji was misinterpreted a lot. And so to my mind, that says, well, use hard eyes and don't use grinning face with smiling eyes. Pick a different one if you want to be happy.
Exactly.
Do you ever have the little fear that just as you figure out the emoji problem, emojis are going to be passé? You know, we'll be on to the next thing.
I mean, maybe a little bit, but there's stats out there that emoji are super popular and they're growing in popularity. So for the time being, I think it's very relevant research.
Yeah, well, they're cute and we all use them, so we'll stay with it as long as people like it. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Anna Miller, PhD student in Computer Science and Engineering Department at the University of Minnesota. Gretchen McCulloch is a linguist and a writer specializing in language online. Thanks again for taking time to be with us today. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, the science and art of turning data into sound. Ever wonder what the sun sounds like? We're going to take a listen and talk about why your ears are really, your brain, your ears are very good at interpreting stuff, sometimes better than your eyes, and how we're using that in research. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Back, 2 months ago, remember, it seems like yesterday, LIGO scientists announced they'd finally done it. They'd spotted gravitational waves, and they made the announcement with a sound. That's the sound of two black holes bashing into each other another 1.3 billion years ago. But that sound came later, because the actual discovery of gravitational waves was made the usual way, visually, when a LIGO postdoc spotted a telltale squiggle on his computer screen. But what if LIGO scientists had been able to listen to their data and not just look at it? Imagine that chirp sounding out over a set of speakers in the LIGO lab. Somebody's eating lunch and says, whoops, wow, something came through. I just heard it. It could happen sooner than you think. My next guests are experts in sonification, and that is the art and science of turning data into sound. And they've been helping scientists see, or I should say hear, their data in a whole new way. Robert Alexander is a sonification specialist with the University of Michigan Solar and Heliospheric Research Group and director of the Munger Graduate Residences in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Margaret Schudel is a composer and a professor of music at Stony Brook University in Stony Brook, Long Island. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks.
Robert, let's start with the basics. What is sonification?
Sure thing. So I could start with a definition, being that sonification is the translation of information into sound for the purposes of then conveying some new knowledge. And that's a little bit formal for my liking. So if you just think about any way in which we can use our ears to more fundamentally understand the world around us, So it could be a parameter mapping whereby we're taking something like the brightness of a star, we're mapping that to a melody. So the melody goes up and down as the brightness of the star then goes up and down in a binary star system. Or it could be something like audification. Audification is the direct translation of data samples to audio samples. And when you audify something, it's essentially like you're just pushing play on the data plot and you're listening directly to the data. And then you can start to hear some of the richness and some of the nuances in these data that we stream down from things like satellites. And it gives you a really fundamental understanding that you might not receive from just looking at it with your eyes.
Well, let me explore that a little bit more, Margaret. Why is listening to data better than actually looking at it?
So I wouldn't say it's necessarily better, but it lets us use a different part of our brain. So there's a reason that we evolved to have both eyes and ears. So why not use that when we're doing science?
Robert, I understand you've been working with scientists at the University of Michigan to make sounds from solar wind. And let's listen to some of that solar wind. That is the sound of solar wind. Robert, first tell us, what is solar wind?
It is indeed. So the solar wind is a stream of highly charged particles that's constantly flowing outward from the sun. It's something akin to the sun's atmosphere that you could say is constantly blowing past Earth, and it creates things like the aurora borealis, the northern lights, that dazzling light display that we get up in the hemispheres. And when we do something like send out astronauts, when we send out satellites, we need to know when there's something like a large coronal mass ejection that's shooting out particles, and we have to then bring in the shields on satellites, or if there's an astronaut out, bring them back into the spacecraft. So our ability to predict and forecast space weather is very important in terms of the sort of exploration work that we want to do.
You know, that sounded to me like the end of the record, an old vinyl record, and the stylus is just going round and round.
Yeah. And so what we're hearing there, actually, if you think about the sun, it's this very dynamic, turbulent system. I mean, it's the source of all life on Earth, which is really humbling. But what we're listening to there, it's the dynamism in the data. We're listening to there the magnetic fluctuations. And so we're listening, it's the wind satellite, which is, there's a magnetometer instrument, and we're listening essentially to thousands and thousands of data samples, and it sounds actually a bit like wind hitting a microphone. And that's kind of cool that it actually relates back to something like terrestrial wind here on Earth.
Yeah. And I know that you're a composer by training, and before the sun stuff, you were making music based on dancers' movements. So are you just thinking about sound all the time, and then you thought about this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even at a very young age, I like to just, you know, drop rocks into an air conditioner just to see how they would sound. And I was very much enthralled by the world of audio. And now it's definitely grown into thinking about, in my time in higher education, thinking about how can we use sound as a medium to explore the world around us. How can we use sound to supplement and augment the creative process? And then how can you infuse the scientific process with the creative process and kind of achieve some unexpected results oftentimes?
Well, let's talk about unexpected results, or how you massage the sound, because not too long ago, I know you were listening to some solar wind and you heard this. Wow, what is that whooshing sound?
Yeah, so that is an ion cyclotron wave storm. At least that's what we've discovered through the research that we've then followed up and conducted. And then we published in the Astrophysical Journal just recently. And so if you can imagine that first sound, which is kind of bland, you know, vanilla, it was just wind hitting a microphone, not that much going on. And then there was this wonderful pause as I was listening through the data, and all of a sudden that whoosh just emerged out of nowhere. And to me, that was music to my ears, because these types of features, when you hear them, you immediately recognize that there's something different, right? And we start to build up this auditory vocabulary and sort of auditory palette, so that then, I mean, you could stick a supercomputer on this, you could run, you know, an automated statistical signal processing algorithm and say, find all these kind of things, but it's hard to tell it, you know, find something that's novel that may also be of scientific interest. So as I was listening through years of this type of data, that's the kind of skill that I refined. And that's why this particular feature stood out, because it's so clear and it's so unique.
Say you heard something by listening to it that the other scientists have missed in their research by not listening to it.
Yeah, and actually, there's just so much data. A lot of best practices involve doing summary plots. So we take a year's worth of information, and then we run the spectrum. So we get a sense for, yep, that looks like a traditional. Oh, we see a spike down here in the low frequency. Oh, we have a spike in the high frequency. But what you miss is you miss a lot of the subtle nuance. And that's just because the sciences are inundated with an absolute flood of information right now.
When you heard that, did you have to go tell, hey, NASA, listen to what I discovered? Did you have a eureka moment like that?
I was actually sitting at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, so I had the opportunity to just turn to one of my colleagues right next to me, and I was actually compiling a list of features. So there were 610 features that I had identified as potentially interesting. We boiled that down to 10, and then this was the number one on my list.
Wow. Margaret, you've been collaborating with a team over at Brookhaven National Laboratory, a team that includes your husband, Kevin Yeager. First, explain what you were doing over there at Brookhaven.
Right. So I'm working with my husband, and he works at the Center for Functional Nanomaterials, where they shoot X-rays at little tiny particles to try to figure out what they might be useful for.
And so the X-rays bounce off. And...
So the X-rays, yeah. So instead of a traditional X-ray like you might think of with your hand, and you shoot the X-ray through it, and it doesn't go through where your bones are, and you get the picture of your hand, the X-rays, in fact, scatter off the materials and then are detected.
Mm-hmm. And then you decided, maybe these make a sound when this happens?
Yes. So I've done a lot of sonification of data before this, and I was trying to understand really exactly what my husband was doing when he went off to work, and he was explaining how they scatter off. And then he says, and then we get a Fourier transform of the real space density distribution of the atomic structure. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And he says... Wait, why do you know about Fourier transforms? And I say, because we use them all the time in computer music. And so it was a really, really natural way to do this sonification, was using this sort of formula that we have in common in our fields.
Mm-hmm. So let's listen to the sound that what happens when X-rays bounce off a metal alloy. Wow. And that means something to you.
It does. So the high pitch means that the atoms are spaced really closely together. And the fact that they are sort of constant means that that pattern is pretty regular.
Mm-hmm. Now that I wanted to play it a little bit from the same metal alloy, but this time it doesn't sound quite the same. Wow, that was... Why do they not sound the same?
Right. So if you can imagine that you have these X-rays and they're being generated in this machine that is about a half a mile in diameter, and then it has to go down a couple other machines, including vacuums and lasers and freezers. And then you're shooting it at something which is 1/25,000th the width of a human hair, and then trying to catch the things that bounce off of it. Things like misalignment happen a lot. And so what happened here is somewhere along the way, something wasn't in the right place, and the detector didn't detect anything.
Oh, so it's very easy just to listen to it instead of having to look at all the squiggles on graphs and paper and stuff like that, or oscilloscopes and things.
Exactly. And I like to imagine that they're pouring chemicals back and forth in beakers, and then they listen. And, oh, I better go fix the machine.
Did that really happen? Did you tell them, hey, I heard this and, maybe something wrong with the alignment?
Well, it's going to be in the new, what we're affectionately calling the Frankenlein Beamstein, will be sonified in real time so that the scientists can be looking at the computer or preparing samples and then hear when things are going well or going poorly, just like in a hospital.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that both of you are composers, so I know that you're listening all the time for these sounds. What attracts you, Margaret, to these sounds as a musician?
So I've been doing computer music since I was about 15, and I go to a lot of conferences and hear a lot of music, and there's something about these sounds that's pretty unique. So I'm hoping to use them in a musical composition in addition to the scientific research.
Sort of like Cage's music he used to have years ago. And Robert, has nature ever surprised you with a really beautiful sound? You sonify a data set and out comes this gorgeous sound?
Well, actually, even the very first moment that I sonified a piece of data and was able to then actually just listen to the raw hum, that was just such an awe-inspiring moment for me, because I actually wasn't sure if my algorithm was just a little bit wrong, because I heard this hum in every single file that I was generating, and I was like, all right, I have to go back to the drawing board. I'm probably doing this wrong. And then actually crunching some numbers and recognizing I'm actually listening to the rotational period of the sun. And not only that, I can hear harmonics in the solar magnetic field. So I'm listening to resonances. And so I'm hearing now an octave, a fifth, a musical third. So to be listening directly to data and to be hearing musical intervals then emerge from this data, that was so exciting for me as a composer, just to think, you know, now what else can I listen to? And certainly there have just been so many instances where you hear whooshes and warbles, and working with scientists and sonifying things like coronal mass ejection, so massive explosions, and they actually sound like massive explosions. So it's always fun to sit in a room with them and just kind of gather around the latest explosion that we find.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International, talking with two scientist composers, Margaret Schindel and Robert Alexander. Do the scientists look a little askance at you guys when you say these things?
Right? You know, I think they
You can talk. We're amongst friends here.
They used to a lot more, but sonification, I think, is sort of entering their vocabulary now, especially we're in this era of big data, and they're just scrambling to find something to help them understand. And our ears are really good at picking up regular patterns. We hear them as pitch. And computers have sound cards built in. So this is something that's an accessible way to add knowledge about this big data that they're all completely obsessed with.
Well, that's an interesting point you make, because we are in the era of big data. Big data is everything. And perhaps we've reached the limit of what, you know, visually we can see and make a pattern out of. But now our ears take over.
Absolutely. And I know that the initial inkling is to just think like, oh, you know, we're listening to things. It's touchy-feely. Sound isn't that subjective. But I mean, truly, we are able to extract information from sound that we can't get through any other means. Like, I don't know, what is your favorite recent album that you've listened to?
My recent album. I was just listening to some Broadway musicals. I like Broadway musicals.
Oh, perfect. So, So now if you were to just try to describe the Broadway musicals over the air, you could talk for an hour.
Right.
And just pushing play on the soundtrack instantly would convey a type of information that people just they couldn't get it otherwise. And it's that sort of qualitative richness that just lends so much to the entire scientific method and to the entire research process. And you can't get it from your eyes.
Could we have done sonification before the advent of computers? Are they critical for doing this?
We did do sonification before computers. So Galileo actually did an experiment about the acceleration of balls. He dropped balls off a tower, but he also built this inclined plane with bells on it, and they were spaced according to the quadratic formula. And because they rang in a regular rhythm, that meant that it was accelerating.
That's interesting, because, you know, I remember back in the day, I'm thinking of biofeedback, when that was pretty hot about 30 years ago.
Sure. Well, I'm actually doing some biofeedback sonification work, and we're doing a lot experimenting with breath. So I'm taking a user, someone who just really wants to relax, and then you can sonify the breath in real time, turn that into music, turn that into the sound of whooshing wind, and just the way in which it immediately enhances proprioception. So that is just to say, the effect that it gives to tune you into your own body, it's deeply relaxing. And this is something I'm going to continue to explore, just because it's been a lot of fun.
Well, you know, today we would call it mindfulness, I think, back in the
Indeed, it is underneath the umbrella of mindfulness, certainly.
Margaret, are you doing work with that too?
I'm sort of doing the opposite. So I am making unpleasant sounds so that people who have problems with their gait, they're going to listen to their own music library. But if they're having problems with their gait, it's going to distort their music, so they can't hear it correctly until they walk correctly. And this is working with people with Parkinson's, but we're also hoping that anyone that's having problems with motility might be able to use this system.
Wow. Robert, we want to thank you both very much, Robert and Alexander, Margaret Schindel. We're going to go out, Robert, with one of your compositions, Music from the Sun. Tell us a little bit about this piece as it starts up.
Sure. So what we're going to listen to is a data stream that was gathered by the Advanced Composition Explorer satellite. We're going to listen to particle velocities. We're going to listen to a cloud of voices that represents the temperature of the sun. And we're going to hear a lot of whooshing as the solar wind does its thing.
And you can hear Robert Alexander's full track, Music from the Sun, at sciencefriday.com/sun. Coming up, one of the trickiest organisms out in nature. They can mimic animals, make toxic chemicals. We'll talk all about the orchid. Stay with us and listen. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Spring has sprung, which means it's time to get your blooms in order. And one of my favorites is the orchid. But there's more to this fascinating flora than just a pretty flower and a sweet-smelling bloom. Orchids, if you didn't know, are masters of deception and adaptation. They can mimic insects. They can produce all sorts of chemicals. And there's even an orchid that can shoot pollen out of its flower. All in the name of pollination. And that is the topic of our latest macroscope video. I'm going to chat all about orchids with my next guests, Luke Graskin, our video producer, and Mark Kachadourian. He's the director of the Nolan Greenhouses for Living Collections and the curator of the orchid collection at the New York Botanical Garden, which is having its orchid show winding up this weekend, right? Mark?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes, this is the last weekend of the Orchid Show. It ends on Sunday, so definitely get up there soon.
Okay. Well, Luke, let's talk first about these orchids that that drew you into the latest macroscope video.
Yeah, I suppose you can say I'm a little bit like a pollinator or a green thumb. I got kind of sucked in myself. I was kind of intrigued by this story or this idea that there's a plant that uses trickery in order to fuel its sex drive, which is a fascinating idea, and these orchids do that.
Sounds like people.
It does, doesn't it?
Right.
So they use manipulation and trickery, and more than that, it's a story of evolution, of the kind of power of evolution. You know, these orchids can't see, and they have limited sensory, and yet they're able to manipulate other animals into becoming pollinators for them, and I find that absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, and it's in your latest video, and you shot a lot of beautiful flowers for this video. Did you have a favorite?
Yeah, definitely. My favorite by far was an orchid known as the Darwin Star Orchid. Actually, it's right next to you. You can see it's a big white orchid, and it's got this long green tube coming out of the back. Now that long green tube, when it was presented to Darwin, he thought about it, and he's like, what on earth would that be for? So that green tube is actually a nectar spur. And Darwin theorized that there was a moth with a 12-inch tongue that would stick its tongue all the way down there to get the nectar and in the process pollinate the orchid. A lot of people at the time thought that's ridiculous, but it turns out he was right. There is a moth that actually is the pollinator of this orchid, and it's a wonderful example of coevolution.
And somebody discovered it years later.
Yes, yeah. They actually, maybe about a decade ago, they actually filmed it, the orchid actually, the moth sticking its tongue all the way down the nectar spur.
Mm-hmm. Your video also talks about orchid deceptions. What is the trickiest orchid that you came across? Trickier methods that they use?
Well, they're all very, very tricky. I guess the one that stuck out to me was the monkey-faced orchid, which looks exactly like it sounds. It looks like there's a little baboon staring back at you if you look at this flower. At the center of it is this little kind of lip, which is a modified petal at the middle of the orchid. And if you look at that closely, that little petal looks like a mushroom. And this orchid actually exudes the odor of mushrooms in order to entice fungus gnats to come over and deposit its eggs on it. Now, the fungus gnats, they can't deposit their eggs, so the orchid is just tricking them into becoming its pollinator.
That's tricky. You know, I've seen this picture before because I'm into orchids, and it always looked to me like it was Dracula.
It does.
It's like trachelena.
It looks like a lot of things.
Depends on who you ask, right?
Yeah. Well, if you ask a fungus gnat, it's a mushroom. If you ask us, it's Dracula. And if you ask the internet, it's a monkey face.
Mark, you've worked with this orchid. Does it smell like a mushroom?
Absolutely, yeah. Without a doubt. Looking at the flower, of course, we see that face first and foremost whenever you see it. But then when you inspect it just that little bit closer, you do notice that the lip has even the little gills that you would see on the underside of a mushroom cap. And when you get your nose in there, it smells exactly like fresh mushrooms, without a doubt.
Mark, you've said that one of the cruelest orchids is the bumblebee orchid. Why do you say that?
Well, I've kind of always jokingly referred to it as nature's cruelest trick, because these orchids that are terrestrial orchids native to Europe have evolved a pollination mechanism in which they mimic the female of the species of insect and actually trick the males into mating with the flowers. The insects actually mate with the blooms and in doing so inadvertently pollinate them. So it's sort of a even crueler deception than looking like a food resource, but instead looking like, you know, I guess the most beautiful mate you've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Our number 844-724-8255. We're talking about my favorite subject, and that's orchids. There are orchids that smell horrible to us but are pretty attractive to flies, right?
Oh, absolutely. There are orchids that smell like you should be checking the bottoms of your shoes, in that they smell like all sorts of horrible things, from rotting fish to feces, you name it, all for the efforts and purpose of attracting a pollinator. I even brought a couple
with me today. Let's see what you got here.
I have this tiny little orchid called Pleurothallis ornata, which has these small triangular purple blooms. But if you look closely, the edges of the flowers have these tiny light white little tassels that are moving at just the slightest little breeze.
Oh, yeah.
And what those tassels are, is those little ornaments on there, are actually mimicking the maggots that would be feeding on that type of whatever that orchid smells like, and in doing so attract other insects to visit and lay their eggs. And even that, though that bloom is very, very tiny, if you get up very close and smell it, you can get a whiff of what it smells like. It's kind of fishy and gross at the same time.
Yeah.
A little bit of low tide in there, I think.
That's a good way of describing it. That's a good. What else have you brought with
you? I've got probably one of the smallest orchids in our collection. This is a plant called Oberonia, which has these tiny fan-like leaves. But a friend of mine described it as sort of a human, sort of a living cat toy, and that the flower spikes are covered with all sorts of fuzz and little hairy bits. And the flowers themselves are amongst the smallest flowers of any plant in the world, with blooms only 1 millimeter in diameter.
So these cattails are the flowers?
Those are the inflorescence. Each one of those tails has about 500 to 600 individual blooms on it. So if you were to hold that plant in the palm of your hand, you're holding just under about 2,000 individual orchid flowers in one hand.
Can you grow an orchid from the flowers?
It would be grown from seed.
From seed.
You can do that. It's a bit of a complex process because most orchids require a specialized relationship with fungi for those seeds to germinate. So it's best if you were going to try to find an unusual plant to go to a nursery where it's already started. It's a little bit of a laboratory experiment to grow orchids from seed.
That's probably why I had back in the day, I mean, around World War II, when people were getting interested, they said, oh, you can't grow an orchid. It takes so much skill in a laboratory and a glass beaker and thing like that.
Exactly. So now science has actually cracked the biology and reproduction of the orchid, so much so that what used to take essentially decades for a plant to reach blooming size, now through horticultural and scientific research, we can get blooming size plants in 3 to 4 years. So we've cut the time down considerably.
All right, what have you got next for us?
Probably my favorite orchid, which I was so happy to see opened in the greenhouse. This is called Catasetum. And if you look in the center of the flower, there's a little figure sort of standing there. He looks like a hobgoblin. And if you look, his arms are crossed. What those arms are triggers. Now, I'm going to have a little fun here. Take your finger, reach into the flower, and touch those triggers. Just press on them lightly.
Press forward. Oh, look at that. Look at that. Came
and
right off
what
of my
that
finger.
Orchid does is it actually shoots the pollen out of the bloom. So it just as the pollinator visits, with just a simple touch of that trigger, it fires the pollen and attaches it to the back of the insect with a very strong glue. So if you tried to pull that off your finger, it'd be stuck quite well.
You're right. Wow.
And
I'm going to leave it there.
A very efficient transfer of genetic material there. And actually, it fires with enough force that sometimes it even knocks the insect out of the flower.
Is that a good thing?
Well, it makes the insect, in some ways, probably forces him to go visit another bloom so cross-pollination can occur. But they're so forceful that some of these catasetums, the pollen can actually shoot up to 2 or 3 feet away from the plant itself. Really, quite a bizarre but very fun pollination mechanism. It really does show the diversity of what happens in this plant family.
What is it about the orchid that attracts the pollinators?
Obviously, color, pattern, fragrance, any number of aspects, depending on what pollinator you're trying to attract. For instance, if your pollinator is a hummingbird, you want a long tubular flower of bright colors that would fit the bill of that hummingbird. And as we discussed earlier, if you want your pollinator is a fly or a carrion feeding beetle, you want to smell like something really nasty and gross, maybe have spots or hairs or warts that really mimic something that they would be interested in.
Yeah, and I know from keeping some orchids in my home that they sometimes have a schedule. They don't smell the same during the day.
No, it all depends on when the pollinator is active. For instance, the Darwin star orchid, since it's pollinated by a night-flying moth, during the day there's almost no noticeable fragrance. But even if you put the plant in a dark room or after dark, the fragrance is overwhelming. It's a combination, some people describe it, of jasmine and mothballs, all to attract that night-flying moth with that 12-inch tongue.
So I've smelled orchids that smell like chocolate.
Absolutely. Also, there's orchids that smell like roses, jasmine, chocolate, coconut. Any fragrance that you can dream up, there's probably an orchid out there that smells exactly like it.
What else? You have a whole bunch of them.
Oh, we've got a number of different things. We've got a bunch of wonderful miniature orchids here, some platystel here with about 600 or 700 blooms the size of a head of a pin. We've got a bulbophyllum, a genus of orchids famous for having foul-smelling blooms with this sort of jellyfish-looking bloom with these long-hanging tassels. And you can see all of the spots, hairs, warts on there, all to attract a fly. Because flies, in one of their pollination syndromes, is they are attracted to movement in their flowers. So if you were going to get up there and smell that, that one's not as bad as it could be if it was in the sun. But it's still pretty rank.
Well, you know, what's interesting about this one is that the flower looks longer than the plant. You know, the actual body, is it hanging upside down?
That's exactly the way you're holding it now, hanging with that pendant flower spike.
Yeah.
And those long tails hanging almost about 8 or 9 inches down is exactly the way it would grow in the wild.
Wow, because it's beautiful, and the fact that it has these three these are the flowers.
Mm-hmm. Those are the blooms,
and they have long tails on them. Is that a reason?
It's all to provide some movement, a visual cue for the pollinator to be drawn closer and closer to the bloom, hopefully getting to the right areas to transfer pollen from one plant to another.
Wow. Okay, you have right here closest to me. Is it? I recognize that. Is that a Paphiopedilum?
That is a Paphiopedilum.
Oh, it's close.
Close. And what's great about these is we're familiar with the temperate members of this group, the Cypripediums, the lady slippers. But this tropical lady slipper even has a deceptive pollination mechanism. Some people have theorized if you look in the center of the bloom, there's a glistening, shiny, sort of shield-shaped structure. And what that mimics is aphids, the presence of aphids. So the flies that would feed on the sweet, sugary secretions left by those aphids are drawn in thinking that there's something there and then inadvertently pollinate the flower. Just one more way that orchids have evolved these amazing and deceptive pollination mechanisms.
Talking with Mark Hachidorian, he's curator at the Orchid Collection at New York Botanical Garden, on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. How many orchids from I know you have the show, the Orchid Show, going on now. How many are in exhibit and how many do you store away?
Well, our permanent collection is actually one of the largest institutional orchid collections in the world, now with about approximately 7,000 individual specimens. And that's the behind-the-scenes collections that will be displayed year-round in our permanent displays. But right now, the Orchid Show is going on its last weekend at the New York Botanical Garden, which we have probably about an additional several thousand, about 5,000 to 6,000 plants in bloom. Of course, we do supplement our collection for the Orchid Show, bringing in beautiful plants for all sorts of different color, patterns, fragrance, but also dotted throughout the show will be special and unique plants from our collections.
Wow, let's keep looking. Is that a dendrobium?
The little yellow is
the one right there.
This is the part of the catasetum.
It is.
You have these huge bulbs, these water storage organs that have evolved, like the stems in a cactus, with this 3-foot hanging inflorescence on it. And even an unusual orchid here, this little Oncidium, sometimes referred as bumblebee orchids, has these great bright yellow flowers, which actually mimic another group of plants. So not only can orchids mimic other animals, insects, there are orchids that even mimic other flowers, because the group of flowers that it mimics are famous for having oil glands that certain types of bees are attracted to. And if you actually look close at the bloom, you can see at the center there's a shiny dot which mimics these oil glands. So they even trick plants into thinking that they're other plants.
Oh, Luke, it's the kind of stuff you saw?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, actually, you still, by the way, you still have pollen all over your hands.
I know.
From that.
It's not going, I'm not taking it off.
It's still stuck to your hand.
It's actually really stuck on there.
Yeah. I was fascinated. What draws all these people in to an exhibit like this? You know, I've given orchids as presents to my mom, and I've seen you obsessing over orchids at Science Friday offices.
But your video up there on our website is fantastic, and if... And you learn so much from it. And one of the things that I saw, I knew about, but I never saw and never realized is that vanilla.
Oh, yeah.
Vanilla comes from orchids.
I had no idea. And that's, you know, one of the great things about orchids is that they have these tiny, tiny little seeds, like really, really tiny. And so when you're consuming vanilla, you're actually consuming the seeds of it, those tiny little black dots. Those are orchid seeds. They shouldn't call it vanilla ice cream. They should call it orchid seed ice cream. I don't know if the marketers would go for that, but it, you know, every time you eat a vanilla from now on, you're going to be thinking of orchids.
Do you have a vanilla?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. We have vanilla vines growing in the conservatory. We pollinate them every year because, of course, the bee that pollinates vanilla isn't there. So we try to hand pollinate them to get some vanilla beans for our own use.
Mm-hmm. We talk a lot about orchid plants, but there's something called an orchid mantis.
Oh, yes. There's a species of mantis that mimics, it looks to us like an orchid. As it turns out, it's not exactly mimicking an orchid, but it mimics a bunch of other flowers. It's like a generic orchid flower mimic, and it lives in these flowers where it hunts insects. And you can actually learn about that as well on sciencefriday.com.
Yeah, we have it as part of your video, and you can see that at sciencefriday.com/orchids, and this praying mantis looks exactly like a colorful orchid. Thank you all for... You're not going home with any of these plants. I want you... They're all staying here.
Maybe I'll let you choose one.
Right. Mark Hachadorian is the director of the Nolan Greenhouse for Living Collections and curator of the orchid collection at the New York Botanical Garden. Thank you for taking time.
A real pleasure to be here.
Be with us today. I want to thank our digital team, whom we never get to thank every week. I want to start doing it this week. Julie Liebeck, Chow Tu, Brandon Echter, and Danielle Peterschmidt. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. And our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you missed any of our program, go to our website at sciencefriday.com, and you can see our macroscope. The orchid video is up there, and it's your last weekend to catch the orchid show at the New York Botanic Garden in the Bronx, as we say. The New York Botanical Garden in Brooklyn is the Botanic Garden, and New Bronx is the Botanical Garden. Have a great weekend. Go see those orchids. I'm Ira Flato in New York.